coming. It's my pleasure to introduce Edwin Ko and Maya Wax Cavallaro from California State. The title of their presentation has got exactly the sorts of words I will trip over, so I'll leave that to you to read, and we'll hand it straight over to them. Welcome with a round of applause. Thank
you. Hi, everyone. Thank you for being here. In this presentation, we'll be talking about some of the outcomes of the practicum on Unangam Tenu, also referred to as ALU, during Coline 2016, in which my colleague Maya and I were participants. I just wanted to say that our two co-authors, Moses Derrickson and Anna Berge, were unable to attend this conference, but we wanted to fully acknowledge and extend our gratitude to them. So this practicum centered around the use of language archives for a variety of different purposes, including language revitalization. And there have been several talks at this conference about this. This practicum, specifically, we'll be talking about the different projects in which archival materials were adapted and transformed into interactive web-based language learning tools. So within the next 20 minutes, I'll first talk about the background of the project, then I'll talk about the language archives that we've been working with and the kind of materials that were available for us. Then we'll describe four case studies and the efforts that went into selecting and adapting these resources for online use. And finally, we'll end with some concluding remarks. So first, the background. So using archives for language revitalization isn't something that's new, but in the past number of years, we've seen an increased use. So, for example, the Breath of Life model has been particularly successful and made a large impact in how we view archival materials and their use in language revitalization. More recently, at Coline 2016, there was a three-week practicum on Unangam Tenu working using archival materials. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with Coline 2016, it's a summer school for community language activists and linguists to receive training in community-based language documentation and revitalization. And so it consists of 2 weeks of workshops followed by 3 weeks of practica. On language documentation, the Unangam Tenu practicum being one of them. So not only do participants learn a variety of different skills, but at the end of the practicum, they employ these skills to create products for things like language revitalization and for linguistic research and other things like that. So now a common issue that's been identified by many people is that for many communities of endangered languages, there's simply a lack of language learning and teaching materials. And as many of you may know, creating new educational resources can be costly, time-consuming, and very challenging. And furthermore, even if there are archival materials of language resources in these archives, it may have been developed under very different circumstances. Okay. So now the purpose of this talk is to describe our efforts in A, using our materials housed in these archives and adapting them to fit the current social linguistic situation, and B, transforming these materials into interactive web-based applications. So we draw from two different scenarios, language scenarios. One is the Unangam Tenu archival materials housed in the Alaska Native Language Archive, and the other is Crow archival materials that are housed in the Little Bighorn College Archive. And Crow is a language of Montana, and these products were made in collaboration with members from the Crow tribe. So the Unangam Tenu language materials have been very well documented from the 19th century onwards, and archival records include things like linguistic field notes, native writings, and bilingual materials. Whereas the Alaska Native Language Archives aims to preserve linguistic materials, the Little Bighorn College Archive includes things like historical manuscripts, personal papers, and things like that. So it's a more general archive. There are, however, linguistic materials placed in these archives, including bilingual materials, audio recordings of oral histories, and many others. So as you can imagine, there's a wide variety of materials that we could potentially work with. But we focus our efforts on two main materials. One is on bilingual learning materials for Unangam Tunu and Crow, and the other is on songs for Unangam Tunu. So in both language situations, there was a push for bilingual education beginning in the 70s, and during this time, many bilingual materials were created for both Unangam Tunu and Crow. Today, the situation is very different, with almost all children learning only English. As for songs, we find both traditional songs and more recent compositions in various formats in the Alaska Native Language Archive, such as lyrics without melody, sheet music, and recordings. So now we'll talk about the four case studies. So in the first case study, I explored the use of this online presentation framework with bilingual materials. So in essence, they're kind of like PowerPoint slides that are online, so they're flexible. And one advantage of such a medium is that you can present information sequentially in small chunks, one building on top of another. and they're designed to be self-paced and interactive. And in what follows, I briefly demonstrate two examples, Unangam Tunu numerals and Crow alphabet. So there are three main dialects of Unangam Tunu. There's Atuan, Atkin, and Eastern. And numerals differ in varying degrees across these dialects. So the textbook, Aleut for Beginners, was in the Eastern dialect, whereas Moses is a speaker of the Atkin dialect. And so these resources were adapted into the Atkin dialect. So there are a number of issues that are raised by this decision, but due to time, I will have to gloss over these issues. Now let me show you what these materials look like at the end. So this is the first slide for the Unangam Tunu numerals, and links to these resources will be provided at the end. On the bottom right, you have these navigation icons, and clicking on the right arrow takes you to the next slide. When you enter a slide, the sound recording of a speaker, here Moses, automatically plays for the recording of the word atakan, meaning one. And these slides use visuals rather than English glosses to aid learners. Users can click on the sound icon to hear the sound recording again. And clicking on the right arrow takes you to the next slide,
Allah.
Where the sound file automatically plays for Allah, meaning two. And these two large dots just indicate that this is the number two. So going to the next slide then displays the word for three. So learners can also click on the left arrow button to go back to the previous slides. So among these slides are intermittent quizzes so that learners can gauge how much they've learned. So now clicking on the down arrow takes us to the first question. Well, what is 5 minus 4 in Unangam Tunu? Clicking on the down arrow reveals the answer.
Atakan.
By playing the same sound recording we've heard earlier for atakan, meaning one. And progressing further down the quiz, we see that questions come in various forms. So before we see a mathematical equation, now it's more about counting the dots. and this was made as an effort to completely remove English as a scaffold. And
Kankus.
The answer, sorry, is kankus. So next I'll talk about the slides displaying the Crow alphabet. So here's the first slide. And again, clicking on the right arrow progresses through these slides. And entering these slides automatically plays a recording. So clicking on the letter A will play a recording of a speaker saying the sound for that letter. And clicking on the word below also plays a recording of a speaker saying that word. And the illustration here refers to the Crow word apa. And so these illustrations were taken from the materials that we used, bypassing the need to create new designs, a skill that I lack. And so now hovering over the word apa reveals the English gloss, nose. So the second case study involves stories and texts. But how exactly do you go about selecting which stories and texts to use? So as an example, here's a story about a boy, a rabbit, and a fox and crow. And there are three main characters in the story performing a variety of different actions. And so this particular text focuses on such properties of a language, such as word order, argument structure, and other things. So this story, words are often repeated, and new constructions or new words are introduced gradually, which makes this a particularly effective resource for beginning to intermediate learners. So for example, we have boy that's repeated, rabbit is repeated, and we have the verb see, and then we have the verb run. But stories, as you may know, aren't always so simple, and even if they do start simple, they can get complex very, very quickly. So even the simplest Unangam Tenu stories I could find in the archive were not very accessible to beginner learners. So examples include these stories from a book entitled Hilada that read that was developed in 1972 in Atka Village. Nevertheless, I attempted to work with these resources. So here's a story entitled Ulah, meaning house. And clicking on the sound icon here plays a recording of Moses saying that sentence. Now clicking on each word plays a recording of that word. And hovering over each word reveals the gloss in English and the Unangam Tenu word in citation form, so that users can go in the dictionary and look at the word for more information. And so for some of the glosses, pictures are added to further facilitate retention of the meaning of the words. And these hoverable glosses have been particularly well studied in computer-assisted language learning. So clicking on show translation reveals the meaning of the sentence in English. So you may notice that first, again, all the English that is relevant to understanding the story is hidden. And so users actually have to interact with this, with these sort of, you know, the words and the different features in order to understand the story. So they have to put some effort into it. So let's turn now to the second sentence, Pitam ulakuchak ngang agupu, which means Peter builds a little house for the dog. So just roughly glossing each word, Peter, little house, for, and built, we'll notice that the word for the dog is missing. In fact, this construction indicates this missing element with this verbal ending, which is referred to as the anaphoric marking. Now, how exactly do you get learners to notice these complex grammatical forms through stories and texts? And stories and texts often require a lot of scaffolding, especially for beginning learners. So in addition, some learners may want more explicit instruction on the grammar. And so these concerns motivated me to turn towards linguistics education, and I developed brief tutorials on the syntax and morphology of Unangam Tenu. So here I'll only talk about the tutorial on morphology, which is helpful for learners and teachers in using Bergsland very, very comprehensive dictionary more effectively. And again, links to these resources will be provided at the end. So specifically, I introduce Unangam Tenu morphology intended for non-linguists using the same story in the previous case study. So we take the first sentence and we unravel the multiple linguistic properties that it exhibits, properties that learners may find useful to know. So throughout the tutorial, linguistic terminologies are underlined, and hovering over them reveals their meaning. So colors and visualizations that were intended for dependency syntax were also used to represent different grammatical concepts, among other sort of linguistic terminologies and things like that. So in order to describe the morphology of a language in greater detail, it's first important to identify what are the most relevant aspects of the grammar to introduce. And so here I distinguish between nouns and verbs before talking about the different morphemes. And this knowledge has practical applications for navigating through the dictionary in which words are organized by their stems. So for example, nouns consisting of vowel final stems in the dictionary are listed with the suffix ha. So the words dog and house would be found in the dictionary as sabakah and ulach. And verbs listed in the dictionary end with the conjunctive mood marker, ich. Looking up the verb form alakuch won't get you anything. You actually have to look for the verb form alalich.
So my work focused on songs. As Edwin said, we found a number of formats of songs in the archive, and I was hoping to make these more accessible to the Unangah community and also to linguists and musicologists who may want to do research with them. So why do we care about songs? We're linguists. Linguists are getting more and more interested in the verbal arts, mainly because things like songs and poetry can reveal phonological structures that either might not exist in regular spoken language or might not be as apparent in spoken language. Also, songs are really valuable teaching and learning tools. Music activates parts of our brain that speech alone does not activate, which can be valuable for learning. Songs are also a great way to expose young children and any learners to the phonology system of a language. And it just makes learning cool and fun. It's also a really essential way to incorporate culture into our language work, whether it's linguistic research or teaching and learning, because you can't separate a language from the culture in which it's spoken. So how do I make these songs, though, available online, leveraging web technologies? So what I did was relatively basic so far, but even just transcribing, or in some cases retranscribing, these song lyrics and putting them online, transcribing the music, and I used Western staff notation, which I discussed on my website as a little controversial, but I thought it was the best thing to do here. But so having the lyrics and having the music online with some analysis already makes it far more accessible than it was when it was sitting in a book somewhere in the archive. And I'm hoping that more work will be done. So here you see examples of dance songs from a 70s recording of an elder named Bill or Willie Cherepanoff, who loved dance music. And you have the sheet music here. If you can't read sheet music, that's okay, because you can listen to the sound file. If you can read sheet music, you can listen and read at the same time. And then I have a little bit of linguistic information and musicological information. I recently realized, while talking to Siri Tuttle, that this particular song has a vowel sound that does not exist in the phonetic inventory of the language of Unangah Tunu. There's no A vowel, but if you listen, so this is what we call a vocable, all of the words in this song. So they're kind of nonsense words that we use in music, like la la la, doo dee doo. And now this particular one could just be a borrowing of the English word hey, but I don't think it is. And Siri Tuttle's actually looking at this with another Alaska Native language right now, where there's a separate sound system for songs and for speech. So there could be some really interesting research. In the case of these songs, the family asked that we not make the actual sound recording available online right now. So it's available through the Alaska Native Language Archive, but we could still share the music online. So I created a computer-generated, basically like piano-ish file that has the melody. That way, if someone wants to recreate this song or hear what it sounded like, you can look at the sheet music, you can see guitar chords, you can read the lyrics, and there's translations and other things available, and then you can listen to what the melody sounds like. There's also, here you see the Unangah Tunu lyrics and the English lyrics, and then a vocabulary breakdown. So you see the roots, and then in this song, there's two different negation post spaces, which is interesting. This was another language lesson for a different song that I thought was a really nice song for beginner learners, because it has animals, and they all have diminutive endings, and then the verbs are all in the imperative form, which is a nice beginning lesson. So this work brought up lots of interesting and really important challenges, I think. First of all, we worked with old and damaged materials often. So for example, there were songs on glass records, which is a pretty rare technology, and it's hard to reproduce those anyway. But the archive actually had to get funding and send these discs away to be digitized. And I call it my chipmunk hypothesis. I believe that in this process, the music was sped up a little bit. The files are a little bit sped up, which changes both the tempi and the pitch of these songs. And the problem is that, unfortunately, we have no way to know what the original sounded like. So I can guess, like I slowed it down 10%, but I'm not sure. We are also working with a variety, the Tuan variety of Unangah Tunu, which we believe is no longer spoken. So Moses, who was doing most of the transcription and translation, had to use a variety that's not his native variety, which is an added challenge. And then there were ethical issues. So the archive has these materials, and legally I could put them all online, no problem. But we want to make sure that the people whose songs these are, and the communities and the families, are okay with that and have informed consent. So we often had to track down descendants and relatives, which takes a lot of detective work. But I also found that written legal documents can be problematic, because in certain cultures, it's a very European tradition. And so in one case, I had permission from an elder to use her song, and she said, "I give you my blessing, I wish you the best of luck, I hope it goes well." As soon as I asked her to sign a document, she became very suspicious, and the whole tone changed. So I think we really need to think about alternatives to written documents. Can we record verbal permissions, things like that? What can we do in different cultural settings? So as you see, technology allows us to adapt archival materials in many different ways to address the many needs and values that both teachers and learners might have. And archival materials can offer more culturally relevant content and design than things that we, especially as outsiders, create by ourselves. Creating educational materials in general requires a whole team of people with all different skills, and by using archival materials that already exist, we're able to reduce this need for a whole team of people. So it's a great resource. Thank you.
I know it's possible for speakers who are illiterate, because I've done it for my projects. I don't know how you'd have to justify it if the speakers are illiterate, but I've run across the same problem where, especially if you get forms that are written in high language, whatever language it is, but even if they're adapted, just the idea of signing a form makes it look so legalistic.
Also, think about if you're working with communities who have a history of like outsiders coming in and then disregarding treaties,
yeah.
Like having people sign permission forms can have a whole loaded meaning.
Yes.
Yep.
I'm curious about, you said the family requested that recording not go online, but you've got the sheet music and the lyrics, so anyone can reproduce that themselves. Is your family aware of that and okay with it?
Yeah, I specifically asked them that, because we had permission to use the recording online initially, and then I read in an article about the digitization process that the family had asked not to put the material online. So I reached out to the family through someone at the archive and said, "Should I not put this online? I was planning to." And they said, "Yes, please don't put the recording online." And then I said, "Is it okay to share like a musical transcription and analysis and the lyrics?" And they said that it was. They just, the recording's their family, it's personal. And it's still available through the archive if you reach out to the family through the archive, but they just didn't want the actual sound of their ancestors singing, I think. Yes?
So you said that you contacted the families, and you kind of qualified what you said about contacting the families with, well, is it an archive? We could put it online, but we didn't want to do that without contacting the families. And I just wanted to point out that just because something is in an archive does not mean that you can put it verbatim online. So maybe you want to elaborate by what you meant by that statement. Like, did you have permission from ANLA to put these files online or these materials online?
Yeah, that's a very good point. We were talking with the archivists at the Alaska Native Language Archive, and also at the collection in the library, I forget what the name of the other collection is, Alaska and Polar Regions Collection, about that, because, with these particular materials, it was like they were already available through the archive, they were already kind of publicly available somewhat online, but is that we had, the archive specifically, and also we as linguists have a higher standard than necessarily the law when it comes to things like this. So when I was republishing this stuff on a web page, as opposed to just having it available through the archive, we wanted to go back. The form, the deed of gift form, didn't exist when most of these materials were given to the archive. And so we wanted to go back and like retroactively have families sign the form and make sure that they're still okay with these materials being out there, and then specifically ask if we can share it on a web page like this that's not for profits, for educational purposes, but it's a little more publicly available.
I was just wondering about the underlying technology that you were using for the slides, if you could elaborate more on that, and what's required for the hosting. And
right.
Is this all just pure JavaScript?
Yeah, so for the slides, there are two versions. I mean, if you are a programmer, then they offer this sort of package where it's like a template where you can sort of change things if you know how to code. And it does, it consists of, you know, JavaScript and I believe it's just JavaScript, HTML, and CSS. But for non-programmers, there's the link that I provided before, which is just slides.com, which offers the same template, but it's more interactive, sort of where it's like a PowerPoint, but online, where you can create them and things like that, you know. And so for the ones that I did, they're just hosted on my own sort of web server. Mm-hmm.
In order to host the audio, does that require programming?
I haven't looked too much into the slides.com portion, but I suspect that it is, but I'm not 100% certain. Yeah. Yep.
I was just wondering if these materials have been, like, if you've reached out to local communities that are doing language things to get the things that you've made, like, put on their own websites,
mm-hmm.
or linked to them.
Yes. So for the Unangam Tenu materials, they've been shared with the community on St. Paul, and there is interest in putting a link to these resources, but ideally, I wouldn't want a link to my own webpage. Ideally, these resources can be sort of moved onto their own server. But right now, in order for me to make changes, it's easier for it to be hosted until the sort of, you know, the formatting and content has been really fine-tuned. For the Crow community, it's also the same thing where I've talked to the tribal members, and they've mentioned bringing these resources onto their own tribal website. And again, I'll have to first fine-tune these resources before that's done. Yeah.
Waiting to hear back from someone at the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, who she was going to talk to me about putting some pictures up on the songs page, but also making the song page available on their website instead of on the
website. I saw a hand over there. Oh, yep.
Is it the plan to integrate it with the community? I mean, like Curl, for instance, my wife's Curl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you guys going to try to integrate it with their curricula? Like they have like an active.
Yeah. So I'm in touch with the Crow Agency Public School, and I've been talking to the principal there, and they've actually been using some of these resources in their classrooms. So, for example, in their pre-K immersion classrooms, they've been going through using not particularly these specific ones, but something like this where we have these slides. But these resources are available for the schools on the reservation there, yeah.